Talk Shoe. Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Schinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Jurnov, and welcome to another edition of ESI Bytes, where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you can download it to an iPod or computer or whatever device you want to listen to it on. Today we have an excellent show as we talk about the really important topic of early case assessment. With clients litigating less and less in 2009 and 2010, one has to ask why. Is it the recession? Is it the prospect of building what sounds expensive, an EDRM process to capture data before getting too much of a handle around a case? Whatever the reason, one thing is clear. Today there's less full-blown litigation, even if there are still plenty of disputes occurring. One possible solution to the problem is better early case assessment, and that is one reason this term is becoming so popular. Today, I have an outstanding panel to talk about this with two attorneys from two cities known for their litigation strength. Ed Rippey is a partner from Washington, D.C.-based Covington & Burling. He litigates complex commercial cases in numerous fields with a focus on patent litigation. He's managed matters throughout the country for several Fortune 500 corporations. In addition to patent law, these matters have included such topics as antitrust, consumer, transportation, energy, sports, environmental, copyright, communications, and securities law. In addition, Ed co-chairs the firm's e-discovery practices group and regularly speaks nationwide on the subject. He's involved with the Sedona Conference, working group on electronic document issues, IQPC's e-discovery advisory board, the LexisNexis Litigation Solutions Advisory Board. He had worked with Applied Discoveries Advisory Board. He works with DRI's eDiscovery Committee and CPR eDiscovery Committee. Ed's given lots of speeches and presentations nationwide on eDiscovery and on related topics such as patent litigation, risk management, cost containment, privacy, Web 2.0 issues, instant messaging, and document retention and destruction. These include a few examples, presentations at conferences and symposiums sponsored by the American Lawyer Media, General Counsel, Applied Discovery, BNA, CPA North America, Encore Discovery Solutions, ESI Bytes, I might add, Georgetown University's Advanced eDiscovery Institute, International Association of Privacy Professionals, Inside Counsel, IQPC, Legal Tech, LexisNexis, Lorman, and Pike Fisher. And when he's not presenting, he's actually practicing law, too. So, Ed, great to have you on another show.
Yeah, thanks, Carl. Appreciate it.
Okay, and Bruce Radke's in the middle of the country. He's based in Chicago, Illinois, and he's chair of the law firm Veteran Price's Records Management eDiscovery and Data Privacy Group. Bruce regularly counsels clients, including Fortune 500 companies, on all aspects of records management, including developing and implementing enterprise-wide records retention schedules and electronic communications policies. He's written and spoken extensively on a variety of topics relating to records retention, email, and electronic discovery. His articles and comments have been featured in the Chicago Tribune, the Review of Banking and Financial Services, and Privacy and Data Security Law Journal. Bruce, great to have you on the show. Bruce, since we started off talking about the show early on, I'd like to start with you first as we work our way into early case assessment. You have a records management perspective on electronic discovery, and how does good records management tie into better early case assessment?
Well, Carl, thank you very much for having me on today. And to answer your question, in short, I think records management is the foundation upon which your e-discovery readiness and ECA house rest. By having good records management, you can reduce the volume of the information that's going to be subject to discovery, lowering your ECA costs, and certainly doing better, more educated ECA. By reducing that size of the haystack and organizing your business records, that's the key up front, even before you're involved in litigation, so that you can search. So rather than searching through the entire haystack, you can quickly and efficiently look for only a small portion of the haystack to find the needle. Again, what you're trying to do early on is reducing the amount of unnecessary email and other forms of VSI helps us that you know, the amount of information you're going to have to cull through to do your ECA is going to be much smaller, and you actually understand where that information resides, who are the custodians, and what formats that you're dealing with. You know, in that way, you know, you're going to be able to take a much more educated evaluation of the merits and anticipated discovery costs. Obviously, you're going to be able to do better budgeting and reduction of e-discovery costs. I think one example, obviously not one of our clients, but, you know, we're thinking about conducting ECA, and they actually started doing some ECA on some serial cases. But as they went through the process, you know, they later, after conducting the ECA and making some decisions on whether to defend the cases and whether to proceed with discovery rather than try to get the cases resolved, turned out that they had a number of legacy systems and information that certainly skewed that analysis of whether to go forward with discovery and defend the cases. The point is, had they had the records management house in order early on, they would have been able to identify those legacy systems and that legacy documents such that that would have factored into their decision, their ECA analysis. So, long story short, it's, you know, it's the foundation.
Okay, now, Ed, let's say that you're like many companies. You haven't done the types of things that we've talked about for years of getting your electronic records in order. Is there still hope to do an early case assessment, or is it a lost cause? You know, what are your suggestions?
Yeah, certainly it's not a lost cause. I don't know that today there's a formal sort of understanding or agreement on exactly what early case assessment is or what it means or what it entails. However, long before we started talking in terms of acronyms like ECA, there were companies doing early case assessment to the best of their ability and using the tools that they had at the time. So it's certainly not a lost cause, and I think that the companies that haven't sort of been following the guidance and the rules of thumb out there are trying to engage in it, but there are consequences. I think as Bruce alluded to just a minute ago, you know, some things just become more difficult or less accurate. So, for instance, if you're a company who doesn't have their records in order, it's going to be more expensive to get them in order because you're going to need to get them in order before you understand the case. You're probably going to have a less accurate understanding on the important aspects of the case at the ECA stage. For instance, you probably have a less accurate understanding of the extent of liability, the damages, whether there is even liability. You're going to have less accurate budgeting going on, and you're probably going to have to engage in other mechanisms like sampling of documents and that kind of thing to try to get a grip on the case early on. So to circle back to your question, it's not a lost cause, and I think companies try to engage in early case assessment without following sort of the rules of thumb and advice that are out there now, but it comes at a price, and that price is less accuracy, it's slower, and it's more expensive.
Yeah, it's funny you should mention it's a much bandied term, and a lot of people don't know what early case assessment means. I'm out here in New York, and I was talking to a firm that's letting me use their conference room to do this podcast, and they said, oh, that's an interesting topic. You know, it could mean some vendors trying to sell you something. You know, it's, you know, and, you know, the way I look at it is it's thinking intelligently again about what your case is about. You strip it aside. Let's get to the heart of the case, you know, with whatever tools you're using. You know, it's being a lawyer again,
right,
instead of letting the process dictate e-discovery for you.
And Carl, to kind of follow up on that, and that is, I think it's really important, too, that you want to try to the best that you can, leverage your existing technologies that you already have in place in order to do ECA, and also leverage kind of the processes and policies, how you're handling information kind of on the front end, how you create information, how you manage that during this life cycle, and how you dispose it. All of that work and all that technology that you have invested in should be leveraged in order to conduct ECA whenever you need to do that. I think a lot of times folks think about ECA in very much in isolation. And so whenever a litigation hits, all those policies and all that hard work and all that technology that they have previously in place and they've spent a lot of time and effort into it gets thrown aside. And it's something new that they say, well, okay, now we need to go and figure out to do ECA in isolation. That shouldn't happen. It needs to be integrated to what you're doing currently.
Well, Bruce, you wrote an article I noticed on your bio on early case assessment and use of forensics. And not having looked at the article, could you summarize what you were getting at in that article? How does forensics help with early case assessment?
Yeah, it's early case assessment tools have multiple purposes, and when they are correctly employed, can really result in considerable savings in the context of e-discovery. As early as the initial awareness that litigation is likely to ensue, early case assessment can be used to identify, preserve, and analyze potentially discoverable information. It can also be used to assist in identifying the relevant information storage systems and custodian. So when the time for collection arrives, the tools and technology can also be used to collect information in a manner that is forensically defensible, as ESI must be collected in a manner that is forensically defensible and preserves the chain of custody. Understanding forensics and the role that they play in e-discovery is crucial to your ultimate success in ECA and then also in terms of e-discovery. You know, I think one of the technology tools that are out there is kind of the targeted sampling techniques. And as the technology is being used, you can tweak those samples in order to fuller, quickly, in a much more sophisticated way, target the corpus of information that you're conducting your ECA on.
Okay. So, Ed, when does early case assessment start? When does it end? If you can talk us through the early case assessment life cycle, if you could.
Yeah, sure. I think that the cycle and the parts of it that are emphasized really vary from case to case. But typically, Carl, early case assessment would start as soon as you're anticipating a litigation or you get served with a complaint. And it generally covers and encompasses all the sort of strategic and budgetary decisions that you are aware of at the initial stages of the litigation. And I emphasize that this varies from case to case. It's also going to vary from whether you're the plaintiff or the defendant. So a plaintiff, for instance, might have engaged in substantial early case assessment before even filing the complaint when it was going through the decision-making on whether to file, what the risks and benefits were, what the budget constraints were, what the good and the bad documents were, good and bad testimony, those kind of issues. So a plaintiff might actually be engaging in it long before they even file a suit. A defendant, on the other hand, may be unaware and go to the office one day and get served with a complaint. You know, their early case assessment would start then, when they get served with the complaint, or maybe a little bit before that if they're anticipating service of the complaint. After that, I feel as though things vary markedly from case to case on the so-called life cycle of early case assessment. You know, if you're on a particularly fast docket in the Eastern District of Virginia, or you're running a patent case that's going to be start to finish in 6 months, a prudent litigator might be doing all of that early case assessment right up there up front within the first week because he or she really needs to get a handle on benefits, risks, and costs. On the other hand, if it looks like it's going to be a protracted litigation and it looks like the schedule is moving from the word go, in other words, things are getting drawn out, you know, you might have a couple months of luxury to really sit down and look at some documents, run some searches on documents to see what's out there and to get a better grip on the sort of liability and damages issues of your case. So I feel like parties may undergo similar processes in their sort of cost-benefit analysis of the case. It just the timing might be might vary much from case to case. For instance, if you're on a short fuse, you might not even have time to go look at documents and see how you're going to argue things on paper. You might be making phone calls and doing internal interviews with your client to really sort of get to the bottom of the issues quickly so you can decide whether an early settlement might be in your favor. So those are the kind of factors that might feed into the timing. But by and large, you're looking at, you know, the cost benefits of the case, the liability and the damages, and then budgetary concerns. One other issue that might hit a case that might be a consideration in a case that may not be in another is the litigation profile of the company. So, for instance, how you are approaching the complaint that you were just served with, or how you're approaching the filing of a complaint if you're the plaintiff, might depend on your overall litigation profile. You might be trying to arrange stuff in the new case so that it dovetails with what you've done in other cases on the discovery and the strategic and the cost fronts, or you might be trying to sort of separate that out from your other cases for whatever reason, or you might be needing to think about whether the case is a class action or it's a Rule 20 joinder case, or whether it truly is just a lone plaintiff out there. You can probably tell I'm mostly on the defense side of cases. So those kind of factors that feed into your company's litigation profile can become important at any stage of assessing your case, but particularly at the ECA stage.
And Bruce,
I'd be curious if Bruce has a similar sort of take on the life cycle.
Yeah, absolutely. And I also think that it goes without saying, but I think it still needs to be said that, you know, in my mind, ECA is kind of a continuing process, and that a lot of times folks think of it as either a point or points in time, but as the case progresses and you know, things change, so too should your early case assessment. I mean, there's obviously some very definitive points that you need to assess or reassess where you're at in terms of ECA. But, you know, I think as you go along, it's something that you need to continually factor as changes in the factors that Ed just pointed out change. So.
Yeah, I like to throw out the example of the Howie Mandel game show, Deal or No Deal.
Right.
You know, the case is going on, you open up a few more suitcases, you have a little bit more information, and, you know, the value goes up and down also, depending on what you found. So, you know, once you get a production from the other side, you can look and compare to what you have, and right away you have a chance to make another quick assessment. So, anyway, that's...
And consistent with what you all are saying... Sometimes I will view a litigation as having a new phase when you enter expert discovery when it comes to assessing all the things that we've been talking about for the last 5 minutes or so. So, for instance, you know, when you're lining up your experts and when you first start talking to your experts and you're getting an even better understanding of what your case is all about and what it entails, you know, like Bruce said, you're getting new data in your mind and you are re-evaluating and reassessing. It's almost like a new early case assessment. It's early part of the discovery phase.
Yep. And Bruce, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I think the other thing, too, to keep in mind, it's not just focusing on the case itself, but a lot of times, you know, there's business decisions that are driving how you proceed with the case and whether you settle a case or whether you continue to litigate it. And as you're going through the ECA process, I think that you need, you know, there needs to be an assumption and an appreciation for those business decisions that are going on oftentimes outside the realm of that particular case and oftentimes outside of the attorneys who are representing the client that, you know, will have a very important impact on how you're proceeding and if you're going to proceed. So the scope of ECA has to be broader than just the particular case itself.
Bruce, we've talked a bit about how changing technology makes early case assessment more possible. How could you work some of the newer technologies into an early case assessment workflow?
Yeah, and I think Ed did a great job of explaining all the variables and the factors that go into kind of how ECA plays into the case and where it plays into the case. I think all those variables that Ed talked about will impact on how and when ECA fits into that to the workflows and the technology. I think kind of stepping back for a moment, if you think back about kind of historically how we've handled ECA, I mean, it's really been kind of both processes and technology that have been limited. You've had untargeted custodian interviews in the past and untargeted data collection and preservation and review. And really what you've got is taking this kind of brute force review that really doesn't have a whole lot of lasting value to the case. And you know, and because of that, that affected where you placed ECA in the workflow and how it fit in. Now, fortunately, we've had some new technologies that hopefully you can leverage your existing technology to prepare for and conduct ECA, and now you can have some targeted preservation and review through the data sampling and analytics and metrics. So I think what impact does that have? Well, it impacts upon the fact that you can do ECA much earlier and incorporate in the workflow much earlier, and as we just talked about, allow you to continue to conduct ECA throughout the course of litigation in a somewhat more cost-effective manner.
You know, Ed, one of the areas, I mean, I work a lot in early case assessment with concept searching tools. Typically, the tools that have been targeted at early case assessment work with keyword searching to perform this task. You know, where do you see the marketplace going with that? Do you see issues with keyword searching to quickly hone in on information needed to assess a case? You know, what's your sense of that area?
Yeah, I mean, I might sound like a broken record on this point, but it does depend for me on the type of litigation and how the parties are situated. But for as a starting matter, search terms can be very, very useful at the early case assessment stage on, for instance, getting a better feel for the volume of documents. If the document collection is very conducive to search terms, you could probably even pluck out the hot documents, you know, in the good or bad way. And I rely on this, you know, invariably at the start of a case to get a better feel for what's going on and to engage in the type of risk-benefit analysis that we've been talking about. There are a few issues that I notice in certain litigations. So, for instance, maybe the documents are isolated or concentrated with certain custodians or certain areas, like certain servers, certain physical locations, and these pockets are not so conducive to keyword searching for whatever reason. You know, some antitrust cases, for instance, I've found it's hard to formulate effective search terms. And I find that in those scenarios, a lot of times it's better just to sort of target an area. I wouldn't say as a replacement to search terms, but in addition to search terms. One other issue that you have to roll into the mix is, are you entering an e-discovery stipulation that concerns search terms with opposing counsel? So you might approach things differently if you do have a stipulation that makes an explicit agreement on search terms than if you don't. I mean, I'm probably 50-50. Probably half the time I do enter into a stipulation that it makes explicit agreement on the search terms to be used by parties. The other 50% I don't, and I just do what I think is defensible under the law. And I'd be curious to hear Bruce's thoughts on that. But I think that it does depend, but that's an issue. You know, what you do with search terms at the start, that is going to be affected by whether you anticipate, at least, entering a stipulation on search terms with opposing counsel.
You know, also you create biases in the case by throwing a term in there where you think the data is going to hits are going to come.
Absolutely.
Right. Yeah, I think it's a bit of a controversy in you know, amongst lawyers that I talk to in terms of whether or not you want to even try to reach an agreed upon search term. You know, on one hand, you know, provides a level of comfort that, you know, hey, if we search for these terms over these repositories, you're going to be somewhat hard-pressed to have your opposing side say, well, you didn't conduct a thorough enough search. But on the other side, and I think there's a concern about kind of opening the kimono and revealing some of your strategies to the other side. You know, so I think, you know, as an earlier point, I think it really depends upon each case. And I also think really depends upon the client as to where, you know, how they are in terms of the learning curve and where they're at in terms of being ready and what they can do, how far or whether or not you push trying to come up with the agreed search terms.
Yeah, let me just amplify one thing Bruce mentioned. It's sort of letting opposing counsel in on your litigation strategy, which, you know, as Bruce says, by definition, you're doing that to agreeing to search terms. But one factor to consider, and it varies immensely from case to case, is which party is the one that is first suggesting the search terms. So if I'm a plaintiff, I could have a simultaneous swap with the defendant in which I introduce the plaintiff's terms, suggested terms, the defendant's, or both of them. So if you're really, and you're giving away differing degrees of sort of litigation strategy by doing that, but it does matter which list you're suggesting. So for instance, if I'm plaintiff and I'm suggesting a list for the defendants, well, you know, you would draw different conclusions than if you were offering your own list, because you're looking at it from the offense or the defense. So that's another factor where I've had variations in litigations about whether I'm submitting my list, suggested list, their suggested list, or both of them. I've done it all three ways, and there are different considerations for each one.
You know, Ed, I think that's a great point. And the other thing, too, you know, I don't know if you've experienced the same thing, but, you know, I think as you're going through the process and developing your search terms and checking out your results, I think as you're going through the process, it kind of underscores kind of lessons learned from my end, right? And that is how important, you know, having your records management house in order before this takes place, because you can have the world's best search terms, but, you know, if you're pointing them to the wrong repositories or incomplete repositories, then obviously that's going to skew your responses or skew your results. And that's, you know, going back to the earlier point, that's why it's so important to have your records management house in order to conduct really focus and, you know, thoughtful ECA.
You know, I'm going to ask this to you, Bruce, but I wouldn't mind Ed's opinion on it also. To me, it seems like there are several battles being fought and you discovered right now. One is building the dream process where you can dump data into a system and it flows through the EDRM process, each of the stages at lower and integrated prices. A lot of people look at that and say, boy, this is like a big manufacturing production. This sounds expensive just by definition. You know, the other side, is doing as much as possible to avoid paying to litigate and all those EDRM steps. You know, are these fights diametrically opposed? I mean, what's your sense of this?
Let me give you the typical lawyer's response. Are they diametrically opposed? Yes and no. You know, I think ECA is not a tool per se. It's really kind of a method, and unfortunately, it doesn't generate a whole lot of savings early on. You know, it's not kind of about those kind of upfront savings. So you've got to invest at the outset to learn more about your case and what you need to know about the case. And honestly, clients want to delay spending, so ECA is kind of counterintuitive to many clients and their attorneys. So, you know, kind of building out that dream processes, you know, I think to a large measure, if you can look at it slightly different, and that is if you're leveraging your existing technologies to do ECA, there's going to be some operational benefits to that, separate inside the litigation, that you're going to be able to recoup. And therefore, I think undertaking those steps in managing your information before litigation hits will have some added benefits in being able to conduct more efficient and more thoughtful ECA on the back end. So, you know, understanding that, hey, you know what, ECA costs money and you're not going to be able to save, you know, recognize those savings early on, but at the same time, you can take some steps even before litigation hits that's going to help your ECA down the line.
Yeah, I agree with that. And just to amplify one point that Bruce raised, this concept of leveraging and how important that is particularly from a business person's perspective within the company. So, for instance, you know, if a company is intent on establishing a system and making some upfront investments that cost X dollars, but that they can identify in the following seven cases, it saved us, you know, X times four in processing and review and vendor costs, I mean, that's well worth it. So I don't look at these concepts as being diametrically opposed, just because, if, like Bruce says, if you look at it a little bit differently and you look at how you can leverage some of these upfront processes and investments into future litigations, then you're in good shape, and they shouldn't be diametrically opposed.
Great. Ed, isn't early case assessment just another way of saying we need to think smarter about our cases? I mean, it includes concepts like proportionality, getting your arms around risk and reporting it to the client?
Yes, I think that's generally a fair statement. I think that's what people are trying to do, is think smarter about cases, particularly in the post-economic meltdown world. All of these ECA issues are all the more important before you get involved in costly litigation. And also, just as an example, you know, if a company is expecting to be sued by, for instance, many plaintiffs, different plaintiffs over the same issue, you know, the ECA, early case assessment, might help that same company make sort of strategic decisions and smarter decisions for future cases. So this idea of sort of smartness or getting ahead of the curve or anticipating what's coming down the pike, all those I think are the same ball of wax that companies with early case assessment are attending to and are probably becoming more aware of over the last year or two.
Now for the bad question of the day. I wrote this late on Friday, and you know, I'm trying to think of a way to ask this artfully, and I'll just throw it out there. But Bruce, generally speaking, and certainly not including your clients, do you believe the legal field and client field, you know, working together, trying to get your arms around a case, are smart enough and sophisticated enough to have meaningful talks on the same side of a case about what a case might entail in an e-discovery intensive matter? When there's really so much matter put in at the outset of a case of getting an effective litigation hold in place and avoiding spoliation, and for lawyers, avoiding Qualcomm-type nightmares.
Yeah.
I mean, is there can we rise above those fears and start thinking together about how to handle a case? I guess that's what I'm trying to get at.
So, Carl, as a rookie, I get the first shot at the tough question, right? So thank you.
Well, I've already lost everyone. Carl's called the e-discovery field stupid, you know? I mean, I'm losing every client I've ever had right now. And I'm not, you know, I'm just, you know, that was Friday.
Right.
Yeah, so good luck with this, Bruce.
Right, exactly. So I think, yeah, dance delicately. So I think the issue is, you know, it's you know, how the attorneys, outside counsel, how are we working with our clients on this side of the case to deal with kind of e-discovery and ECA? And I think, you know, I think all the different variables that Ed so artfully articulated, I think that applies and really affects how we're dealing with that here. I mean, you know, you see a huge level of variance between clients, and you know, clients that you know may have their house really in order and who are involved in serial litigation. That's something you expect. But on the flip side, if you look at the same types of clients, who are dealing with litigation all the time, it's amazing to me. And you know, feel free to chime in. But how you know, ad hoc that they handle a lot of e-discovery issues, and how unprepared that they are. And so I think that, you know, a lot of times those types of companies are going to have to get burned before they actually think about this. But I think as things are progressing, and you've got the pension committee decision as the case law comes out, I think the level of sophistication, fortunately, is rising, or at least there's an acknowledgement that it should, increase. And so I think that those discussions that we're having with folks on this end, I think, are becoming much more receptive, and as a result, things are moving forward. And I think, you know, kind of this, there's always this undercurrent, right, that there may be some sort of adversarial nature about, you know, clients want to reduce the size of the corpus of information that they have to deal with. And on the other hand, you know, attorneys are billing by the hour, right? No surprise. So, but I think you know, as things have progressed, the more thoughtful attorneys out there are really trying to get ahead of the curve and trying to help their clients get ready for e-discovery and records management early on to reduce the size of the haystack and work in a much more cooperative fashion with their clients, and to not only educate them, but also to actually put things in place that you're going to be able to work together down the line. Ed?
Yeah, I absolutely agree with this notion that, you know, clients vary. I'm surprised sometimes that a large company is so on top of its game in respect to early case assessment and e-discovery. They really have their act together. They have in-house e-discovery response teams or evidence labs or whatever it is, because they're serial litigators and they understand the importance. And then on the other hand, you know, sometimes I'm very surprised at a similarly situated company is equally sort of behind the curve on these issues. They're aware of them, but they haven't sort of implemented the internal structures to deal with all these issues that we've been talking about. So I wholeheartedly agree about this idea that the clients vary, and it's not always, maybe it's pocketed even within the same company. Maybe they're really good at, you know, preserving electronic documents, but they're sort of, you know, maybe rookies on the search term front. You know, they might have had different experiences and have reacted differently, and they're not sort of at the same level on all the many e-discovery topics that are out there. I mean, the other thing that Bruce mentioned that I thought I would just hit on just for a second is, you know, the hourly rate you know, whether the outside counsel are sort of working in cooperation or in tandem with inside counsel. And, you know, we've seen, you know, there are still hourly rates. They're alive and well, but there are a lot of other alternative fee arrangements that companies are trying to promote because they think that it aligns interest and cooperation a little bit better. And some of them do, depending on the case. Some of them, you know, it's unclear whether they're having an effect. But the, you know, capping certain parts of the litigation on fees, or, you know, requiring you to come back and talk about the budget every month. You know, that might be good enough just to say, hey, you know what, I want a budget update every Monday, first Monday of every month. I want to talk to you for a half hour about the budget, where it's headed. Is it going up or down? What we have anticipated, what you haven't anticipated, that kind of thing. So I feel like, you know, especially compared to the pre-meltdown world, there's a lot more dialogue on sort of aligning the monetary interest in a way that makes people work cooperatively together.
Yeah, I mean, early case assessment, if you're not doing that, you can't have those types of discussions with a client tying in the budget effectively and be realistic. And, you know, and also I want to throw a follow-up in that area, Bruce. I'll throw this to you, Ed. The meet and confer. I mean, how do you make that work if you haven't done a good early case assessment?
Well, you know, that's an excellent point. I mean, you know, some people will walk into a meet and confer, not outside counsel, not having done much of anything, and requesting simply that sort of the deadlines get pushed back, or that we'll deal with search terms later, or whatever it is, which is not really the spirit or the letter of a lot of these more local court rules. So I agree that your initial meet and confers and Rule 16 and Rule 26 conferences, all of these meetings are basically worthless if you don't have some understanding and some grip on your case through early case assessment.
And I think to kind of follow up on that, I mean, I, you know, Ed, you probably see the same thing, but, you know, in those 26F conferences, there's a lot of horse trading going on back and forth. And if you don't know what your case looks like, you don't know what your client's capabilities are going into that, it's very hard to make good deals. And in fact, a lot of times you see instances in which, you know, you think your client's ready, or you think you know a certain aspect of how they can do things, whether it's collection or otherwise, that you make a deal, right? And it turns out that that assumption was incorrect.
Mm-hmm.
So it's absolutely critical understanding, having a good understanding even before you go into those the meet and confers, in order to make good deals.
Why don't I wrap this up with a final general question in case I've missed something with one of my questions. You know, first Ed, then Bruce. So do you have any last tips on early case assessment that maybe I've missed, or that maybe you want to, you know, end with, as sort of like the soundbite of, you know, how to how to think about this area?
Well, one thing we've talked about, I think we've alluded to, but we haven't really uncorked it, it has to do with just staying on top of things from the word go. I mean, early case assessment, I mean, that's exactly what it is. You want to be assessing your case early. I feel like some entities are less aware or cognizant of just how powerful this can be, whether it's like Bruce says, you can walk into a Rule 26F conference and strike deals that you know are favorable. It's never too, or whether it's early motions practice or you're going to file an early motion to dismiss rather than answering the complaint even, all of those strategic, important strategic calls that you have really depend on being diligent up front. So, you know, it's hard to overemphasize just how important it is to be on top of your game right out of the gates. I mean, I find that many of the court rules that are being or suggested stipulations, you know, there were default stipulations before some court. A lot of these are aimed just to motivate parties to engage in ECA and get a grip on their case early. And I feel like that the parties who are really taking that to heart, whether just doing it on their own or being prompted by the court, you know, whatever the motivation and incentive is, it's really important to how your case sort of plays out over the next probably several years if you're engaged in high-stakes litigation.
Well, Bruce, anything like that?
Yeah, and I think that's a great point kind of along that same line, and that is, you know, I think ECA should be viewed as kind of a continuation of your existing records management policies and procedures in your e-discovery preparedness. It shouldn't be viewed in isolation, but it should be developed in tandem with your, you know, what you do. How do you manage your records and your information on a daily basis? And as you're thinking about how we're going to manage our records on a daily basis, solely for operational purposes, also factor into how we can leverage those technologies. And truly, you want to leverage the existing technologies to conduct ECA, but how we can leverage those technologies to conduct ECA in the event we do have litigation. They go hand in glove, and unfortunately, we need to get off the notion that ECA and litigation is somewhat isolated, and once litigation hits, we kind of throw away all our policies and procedures and technologies and go for it, spend a whole lot of additional time and effort when we really could be using a lot of things that we've already got in place to conduct ECA.
Right. All right, well, thank you, Ed and Bruce, for joining us on ESI Bites. Hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with both of you later this year. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibites.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can also remember our show and website phonetically as it's Easy Bites, just the way it sounds, of information. However you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bites, learn more about eDiscovery before ESI Bites you back. This is Carl Shineman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Gurnav, wishing you a nice day.